Nagged by his inability to understand whatever it was Father Martin expected him to learn from the photograph, Kate left the manor house behind, crossed the commandery grounds on foot, and entered the science building. Photo reconnaissance was on the second floor, and upon arriving, Kate asked to speak to Jarvis. Though only 25, Jarvis's skills were miles above the other members of the unit, and Kate preferred the use of his services whenever possible. He explained the situation to the photo tech and asked if Jarvis could sharpen up the picture enough for them to recognize the individuals in the photo.
Bloody piece of cake, chap. When did you want it?
Yesterday.
Got 10 minutes.
But no more than that.
Jarvis led him over to a computer workstation where he fed the photo into a nearby scanner. Once the picture had been digitized, he went to work.
Every photograph is composed of millions of little dots known as pixels. The computer analyzes the entire image and then begins to work at it one pixel at a time. Using a complex series of algorithms, it attempts to identify the most likely arrangement for each individual pixel based on the hundreds that surround it. By doing so, we can gradually clean up the image, correcting the focus, the color, even a perspective if necessary.
There were 11 individuals in all, 6 women and 5 men, and as Kate watched, their faces slowly began to grow clearer. One by one, he eliminated all of the women and 4 of the men, either because he didn't recognize them or because there was no reason to consider them a threat. The 5th and final man was a different story. The man stood with his face partially turned to the camera, a smile playing at the corners of his mouth. Judging from the other people around him, he was tall and well-built, with dirty blonde hair that came down just past the collar of the light coat he wore. Seeing his face, Kate understood exactly what Father Martin had been trying to tell him. The man in the photograph was his old teammate, Bishop. The others were ready and waiting when Kate arrived at the motor pool 15 minutes later. He explained what he'd done, and then passed a copy of the enhanced image to each of them.
Sweet Mary and Joseph.
Well, that throws a wrench in the works now, doesn't it?
Olson was right. Bishop's presence in Boston changed things considerably. Kate was already thinking of the mission as a rescue operation now, rather than a fact-finding mission. Father Martin had been involved in the ill-fated operation from several years ago. He'd met Bishop when the Templar Advancement had first arrived in the city, and knew what had later happened to him at the hands of the Changshi. He'd recognized that Bishop's presence outside his church did not bode well for the congregation, or for Martin himself, and might even signal the return of the Shadows to the city proper. It also explained why Martin had sent a note to Cade, rather than bringing in the usual authorities. The police could do little against one of the Shadows. Bringing in the local authorities would only end with innocent people dead. Rather than do that, Martin reached out to those who'd saved him once before, the secret militant arm of the Mother Church. Cade felt a growing sense of urgency settle over him. They climbed into the SUV assigned to them and got underway. They made good time, straight up 95 into the suburbs of the city, where they switched over to Route 93 that took them into the city proper. Once there, they got off the highway and cruised into the streets of South Boston. A predominantly Irish, blue-collar neighborhood, South Boston was as well known for its St. Patrick's Day celebrations as it was for its high crime rate. The Irish mob had ruled the streets for so long that even when their leadership crumbled in the face of multiple FBI investigations in the mid-90s, very little had changed for the people on the streets. Life went on just as it always had, and eventually someone else stepped up to take the reins of power, just as they always had and always would. Cade had patrolled the area as a young beat cop. This was when he'd first come to know Father Martin. Cade had answered more than his share of operation calls in the neighborhood during his time on the Special Tactics and Operations Team, or STOP. He'd been back once or twice during his years with the Order, but little ever changed in Southie, and it felt only like yesterday that he'd left. As they neared the church, they could see a squad car parked in the driveway of the rectory.
Keep going past the church and park farther down the street.
As they drove past, Kate could see a uniformed officer sitting in the front seat of the squad car, and the telltale yellow crime scene tape stretched across the front door of the rectory confirmed his worst suspicions. It appeared they were too late. Riley found an open spot a few blocks away, pulled in, and turned the engine off.
Now what?
Cade gave it some thought. Having the 4 of them suddenly appear on the rectory doorstep was a bad idea, particularly if something untoward had happened to Father Martin. Kate decided to take Duncan and walk past the church to see if they could get the uniform to tell them anything useful. The two of them got out of the car, turning their collars up against the chill breeze, and headed off in the direction of the church. They hadn't gone half a block before Cade caught sight of a foursome moving down the street toward them. Three men and a woman, and he pointed them out to Duncan. The men were dressed in the black pants and shirts of the clergy, and the woman wore the deep blue habit of a Catholic nun.
Let's see if we can get a bit of information.
As they got closer, Cade stepped out and raised his hand in greeting.
Excuse me, Father?
Yes?
As he responded to Cade, the older of the two men stepped out in front of the other three, as if getting ready to protect them. And Cade noted how all four immediately tensed at his approach.
I was hoping you could help me. I'm looking for Father Martin. Can you tell me if he's still assigned to this parish?
The nun, a young woman who couldn't have been older than her mid-20s, raised a hand to cover her mouth. And Cade felt the level of tension among the group go up dramatically. The priest's eyes narrowed as he looked at Cade.
And what would you be wanting with Father Martin?
It's been a few years, but Father Tom officiated at my wedding. I was back in town on business and thought I'd stop by and say hello. But the police car in the driveway made me think this might not be the best time to drop in for a visit. Has something happened?
I'm Father O'Malley, son, from St. Jude's, a few streets over.
Jake Caruso. This is my friend, Michael Simpson.
I'm afraid I've got some bad news, Jake. Father Tom passed away last night.
What happened?
Some street punk broke in and he...
Watch your tongue, Philip. What will Sister Margaret think of such language?
Sister Margaret happens to agree with him, and I know you do too. So tell the man what he needs to know, and let's all get out of this cold.
O'Malley was clearly old school, and he apparently felt Cade was cut from the same cloth.
I'm sorry to have to tell you that Father Tom was killed last night during a burglary. Police say he must have surprised the intruder in the midst of the crime, and the man panicked, resulting in Father Tom's death.
He stabbed him with a butcher knife 8 times, then he left him to bleed to death on the kitchen floor. I hope he rots in hell.
Do the police have any idea who did it?
Not yet, but I'm confident that Detective Burke will find the culprit before long.
Detective Joseph Burke?
Yes, that's the one. Do you know him?
Another old friend from the neighborhood, eh? I guess we never really stray far from our roots, do we, Father?
That's true, Mr. Caruso, very true.
They spent a few more minutes talking, and then Cade thanked them for their time and let them continue on their way. He waited until they had moved out of sight before walking back to the truck with Duncan and letting the others know what they'd discovered.
So you know this guy, Burke?
He worked Bunko when I was with Homicide. We did a few task forces together. Decent guy overall. Takes the job a bit too lightly for my taste, but he was never a bad cop.
You think he'll help us?
Only one way to find out.
Cade took out his cell phone and dialed a number.
Detective Burke, please.
Cade stepped inside the diner and looked around. Burke, a heavyset man with a close-cropped shock of white hair that always made Cade think of the White Apes of Barsoom, waved to him from a seat in the back corner. Cade threaded his way through the other diners and slid into the booth opposite. The two men shook hands.
Good to see you, Williams. How are the feds treating you these days?
Shortly after Cade had left the force, Burke had come under the mistaken impression that Cade worked for a super-secret arm of the federal government, the NSA or the DIA, something along those lines, and Cade had never disabused him of the notion. It had been helpful to have someone on the inside over the years, and right now Burke was their best chance of getting a line on what was going on.
Good as can be expected, I guess.
Cade signaled the waitress for a cup of coffee.
Thanks for meeting me.
No problem.
Cade waited until the waitress had brought his coffee, refilled Burke's, and walked over to take care of another customer at a different table before continuing.
You hear about that priest down in Southie?
Yeah. Word on the street says it was a burglary gone sideways.
Damnedest thing, too. I mean, the guy was old, right? All the perp had to do was push him out of the way. Instead, he grabs a butcher knife from the block in the kitchen and stabs the guy to death.
Professional interest?
Nah, personal. I knew Father Martin from back in the day. Used to see him at church when I was a kid.
Last I heard, he retired.
Retired from the hospital, but not from active ministry. He went back to working as the assistant pastor at St. John the Divine, back where he started all those years ago.
Burke picked up a dark folder from the seat beside him, looked at it without speaking for a moment, and then seemed to come to a decision. He passed the folder to Cade.
Figured this was what you were calling about, so I brought the file.
Cade opened the folder, and a deep sense of trepidation unfolded in his gut. He hadn't known Thomas well, but the man had been kind to him in a time when kindness was more precious than life itself, and so he'd always had a soft place in his heart for the tough old soldier of Christ. Inside were several 8.5 by 11 full-color photos. The first showed Martin where he'd fallen on the floor of the rectory kitchen, his blood staining the cracked linoleum, and his face turned toward the camera, as if his unseeing eyes were staring deep into the lens. The black handle of a carving knife protruded from his back. The second was a closer view of Father Martin's back, showing several slashes in the fabric of his shirt, evidence of other entrance wounds. Cade counted 10 without even trying. The other photos showed the body from various angles, but didn't give him anything new.
Any witnesses?
No. The rectory houses two other priests, but both were away at an archdiocesan conference, and the housekeeper had the weekend off. She was the one who found him when she came in this morning.
How about trace evidence?
Well, I'm still waiting for a few tests to come back from forensics, but as of right now, we've got nothing. The knife, doorknobs, and sink were all wiped clean. Hair and fiber came up empty as well. I'm having the blood splatters typed, hoping we get lucky, but I'm really not counting on it. Whoever the guy was, he played it cool and seems to have gotten away without leaving anything behind.
Cade knew there was more to it than that, but he couldn't say so to Burke. If Bishop were involved, as Cade suspected, things might just get a lot uglier.
That just sucks. What did the thief make off with? A couple of gold-plated chalices and the money from the poor box?
Not even. Idiot dropped his sack when he turned to run. Damn shame is what it is.
They spent another 15 minutes sharing war stories and catching up on guys they knew. When they ran out of things to talk about, Cade thanked Burke for coming down and paid the bill. As Burke got up to go, Cade reached out and grabbed his arm.
Where did they take Martin's body?
The county morgue was full, so they've got him over at the annex in the basement of Mass General. Gonna go pay your respects?
Yeah, something like that.
Cade waited 5 minutes after Burke had left, and then returned to the vehicle. A few minutes later, Riley opened the passenger door and climbed in beside him.
Well, went straight back to his car and drove off. I took down the tags, but I don't think there's anything for us to worry about. He didn't have a tail, and I don't see any evidence of a stakeout. The rest of the cars along the street are empty. There wasn't any activity in the windows of the building overlooking the diner, either.
Good.
He thought Burke was playing on the up and up, but it didn't hurt to be sure. Cade sat there in silence for a moment, and then made up his mind. He needed a look at that body, and there was no better time than the present.
Get a hold of the other two and let them know we're headed over to the morgue. We'll meet up with them back at the hotel once we're finished.
Roger that.
While Riley was on the phone, Cade opened the storage compartment between the front seats. He pressed a hidden stud and then lifted the compartment out entirely, revealing another, shallower space beneath. He removed several leather identification cases from inside the hollow and flipped through them. Selecting two, he replaced the rest and then reseated the upper compartment. He waited until Riley had hung up and then handed over one of the sets of ID.
Who are we this time?
NSA.
Works for me.
Cade knew that the average municipal employee wouldn't ask too many questions of a representative of the National Security Agency, the arm of the U.S. government responsible for the collection and analysis of foreign communications, and so it seemed like a good choice. Believed by some to be the world's largest intelligence-gathering agency, the NSA was a branch of the Department of Defense, and with that affiliation came a certain sense that the less one knew about its activities, the better. Cade was counting on that reputation of secrecy to allow them to get in and out of the morgue without having to explain what they were doing there. He knew he could have simply asked Burke for access to the body, but that would have resulted in a paper trail. Right now, his meeting with Burke was off the books, and Cade intended to keep things that way. They made the short trip downtown and parked across the street from the annex to avoid the cameras that Cade knew were set up around the government parking lot adjacent to the building. They showed their credentials to the guard just inside the front door and then took the elevator down to the basement where they let the morgue attendant know what they wanted. The attendant led them over to the bank of steel drawers built into the far wall and pulled one of them open, exposing the black body bag that lay inside. He deftly slid the bag onto a portable table, wheeled the table over to one of the examination stations, and then repeated the process in reverse. Once the bag was in place, the attendant unzipped the thick plastic, exposing the body of an elderly man. The attendant checked the toe tag against the clipboard he carried and then removed a file from a nearby cabinet, handing it to Cade.
That's him, and that's the autopsy report. Just what are you looking for?
Cade took the clipboard and smiled at the attendant.
Thanks. Now, if you wouldn't mind waiting in the hall.
Sorry, no can do. Rules say I gotta be here.
Riley?
Yes, sir.
The big man stepped up, took the attendant by the arm, and led him toward the door.
I'm sorry, sir, but this is a matter of national security. You're gonna have to wait in the hall until we're finished. Your government appreciates your assistance in this matter, however, and I'm sure...
Moments later, Riley stepped back inside the room, and then shut and locked the door behind him. He took up a stance in front of it, just to be certain they wouldn't be interrupted. Satisfied, Cade turned back to the autopsy report in his hands. He leafed through it for a few moments, noting the time of death as having been between late last night and early this morning. The pieces seemed to fit together. He could see Martin making the drive to Connecticut, dropping off the package, and then returning early that morning, only to find the intruder in the midst of the burglary. Surprised, the thief reacts without thinking, and suddenly he's got a murder rap to add to his breaking and entering and burglary charges. Cause of death was listed as exsanguination, caused by multiple knife wounds to the chest. Father Martin had bled to death alone there in the early morning darkness, unable to call for help. Cade found himself hoping that the old man hadn't suffered too much, but his faith had allowed him to face death with the same bravery and determination with which he'd faced life. The report noted that the wounds were caused by a common kitchen knife, that the weapon had been recovered at the scene, and that the nature of the wounds matched the size and shape of the blade. The knife itself had been sent to the lab for analysis, so Cade was not going to be able to examine it for himself. But he had the next best thing, Martin's body. He put the report down and turned to Riley.
See, Emmy puts his death sometime last night, early this morning, which means we've still got time to give this a shot.
I'm ready when you are.
All right, you know what to do if anything goes wrong.
Knowing he was in good hands, Cade turned back to the body, preparing himself mentally for what was to come, and then removed the thin cotton gloves that he habitually wore, the gloves that kept him functional and sane. 7 years before, back when Cade worked for the Boston Police Department, he'd come face to face with a supernatural entity he'd come to know as the adversary. That encounter had scarred his body and his soul, and had left him with a few unique abilities. He was about to use one of them now. Cade called it his gift, though for years he had considered it more a curse than a benefit. Still, there was no denying its usefulness at times like this. By touching an object with his bare hands, Cade could read the psychic impressions that had been left on it by the last person to handle it. Thoughts and feelings poured out in his head as if he were actually experiencing them. They didn't last long, a few seconds at most, and the impressions faded from the object over time, so that after 48 hours or so, he was unable to get anything worthwhile from them. But if he got to the object in time, he could learn a tremendous amount of useful information. If he used his gift on the deceased, he could experience their last moments, just as they had. If Martin had gotten a glimpse of his attacker, Cade would see the same thing. In addition, he'd have access to whatever Martin was thinking at the time, allowing for an even greater understanding. The technique wasn't without its dangers, however, for Cade not only saw what the deceased had seen, but experienced it as well. If the priest had been scared, Cade would be scared. If the priest had been injured, Cade would feel his pain. His body would react as if he himself had been injured. Occasionally, the wounds themselves would manifest on his body, which made every use of his gift a potentially deadly one. Riley would be his backup. If it looked like Cade was in trouble, he would break the connection by pulling Cade away from the body. That was usually enough to prevent further harm, though occasionally more forceful measures were required. Cade hoped that today wouldn't be one of those times. With a final nod to Riley, Cade reached out and touched Father Martin's face. Darkness. The sense of being followed. No, hunted, as he scrambled up a long incline, the rocks sharp against the flesh of his hands. Had to warn them all before it was too late. His breath came hard and heavy. His ankle hurt where he twisted it earlier, but he dared not stop. If he did, they'd kill him. There was no question in his mind. It wouldn't be long now. They had released the hounds. darkness, inside the church, the feel of the holy wafer on his tongue, figures moving in the darkness around him, holding his arms out to the sides, the altar steps hard against his knees, but he had eyes only for the crucifix on the wall above the altar before him. Pain ripped through his body, but he did all he could to ignore it, focusing on the message he had to pass on.
The cross, Captain. You must find the cross.
The image of a red Templar cross swam before his eyes, and he concentrated on it, fighting the pain, holding out as long as he could, the cross centered before him. Riley hauled Kate away from the body of the priest, turning him away, just as the other man vomited up a great gout of blood that splashed on the floor tiles at their feet. Blood from a wound that didn't even exist. Cade spit up the last of the blood that had filled his mouth, in the same way that it had filled Martin's, a result of the knife that had been driven into his chest by the man standing before him, a man that Cade recognized.
Bishop.
When he could speak, he told Riley everything that he had seen, including the identity of Martin's killer. They had the confirmation that they needed. Bishop was back, and he was up to no good. But Martin had left them a clue meant specifically for the Order. And if they could find it, they might understand just what was going on. The bar was a dive joint named Maxine's. It stood on the corner of Sunset and Main, not too far from Mattapan Square. It wasn't one of Burke's usual hangouts. In fact, he rarely came to Mattapan, which was precisely why he chose the place. The chances anyone would recognize him were slim to none, and he could get his business done and get out of there before anyone was the wiser. Once his eyes adjusted to the dim lighting, he could see that his business partner was waiting for him in the last booth. He made his way through the crowd, but rather than slide into the booth across from the other man, where he'd have his back to the door, he pulled a chair from a nearby table and sat in the aisle at the head of the table. The man he'd come to see grinned slyly as Burke settled down, and the detective knew the setup had been intentional. He gave the other man his best fuck you smile in return, just to show he wouldn't be so easily rattled. He signaled the waitress for a beer, waited until she brought it, and then spent another minute watching her ass as she walked off again. When he felt that he'd made his point, he turned back to the other man.
It's done. He took the bait.
A smile spread across the face of the man opposite, and that simple gesture accomplished what the gamesmanship before could not. Burke suddenly felt incredibly uncomfortable. The urge to get the hell out of there was practically overwhelming, and he went so far as to slide his chair back slightly before his rational mind regained control.
Chill out, stupid. You ain't got what you came here for yet.
And the patrol car?
I'll make the call as soon as I'm out of here.
Make it now, please.
It was far more an order than a request, but in that moment, Burke decided to do just what needed to be done, get his money, and then get the hell out of there, before things got out of hand. The detective removed a handheld radio from his pocket, checked the frequency, and then pushed the talk button.
Grissom, this is Burke.
Grissom here, detective.
We've got the ICE set up in the building across the street so you can return to regular patrol. Thanks for your help.
10-4, detective. Thanks for the overtime.
Roger that, Grissom. Burke out.
The detective turned the radio off and returned it to the pocket of his coat.
Well, I've pulled the black and white off the site. They shouldn't have any trouble getting inside the church now.
Very good. I believe that completes our arrangement, then.
Not quite. There's still the matter of my pay.
Yes, your 30 pieces of silver.
The blonde man took a small gym bag off the seat next to him and shoved it across the table at Burke. The bag was unzipped, so the detective pulled the flaps open and peered inside. The bag was full of bundles of cash, 100s wrapped in red rubber bands as if fresh from the mint. Burke reached inside, picked a random bundle from deeper in the bag, and without lifting it above the confines of the bag itself, flipped through it, making certain that they were all bills and not stacks of paper wrapped in loose cash. Satisfied with what he saw, he stood and zipped the bag.
It looks like our business is done. If I see you in my district again, I'll arrest you on sight, understand?
Blondie didn't say anything, just grinned that unsettling smile, and Burke decided it was time to get out of there. He grabbed the bag, made his way back through the crowd, and headed down the street toward his car.
Woo-wee! Look at what we got here, boys. What you doing in this neighborhood after dark, Whitey?
Several dark forms stepped out of the alley in front of him, blocking his way. Burke stared disdainfully at the youths. There were five of them, maybe six, not a one older than their late teens. All of them were black, which explained the racial comment.
Damn punks. I'm a cop, and unless all of you want to spend the night in lockup being somebody's bubba, I suggest you get the fuck out of my way.
No one moved.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Burke drew his firearm, pointing it at the group's leader. Now he was pissed.
First said idiot in the bar, and now these punks. Doesn't anybody remember how to show their betters the respect they deserve? Back off or I'll blow your stupid heads off! Oh, shit.
The detective managed to get off the first two shots. The end was never in doubt, though Burke did manage to take three of them with him before he succumbed to his wounds and collapsed onto the street. He'd been hit 8, maybe 10 times, and he knew he had only seconds to live. Already his arms and legs were going numb, his vision starting to gray out around the edges. The survivors hauled the bag out of his grasp.
I always knew I would die cold and alone. Wait, not alone.
Someone stepped out of the dark mouth of the alley to his left. Burke turned his head, letting the blood dribble out onto the street beneath him. And when he turned it back again, he found Blondie standing over him.
Don't you read your Bible, Burke? Judas doesn't escape his fate.
After leaving the morgue annex, Kate and Riley rejoined the other two men at the hotel room they checked into a few blocks from the church. Kate filled them in with what they had discovered.
So now what?
Martin left something in the church for us to find. We've got to find a way to get inside and take a look without the police hanging around.
That's not going to be easy.
Kate agreed. They just didn't have any choice. They had to get inside that church. As it turned out, things were far easier than any of them expected. On their first drive-by, they discovered the patrol car had been taken off the rectory, and subsequent passes didn't reveal the telltale presence of a police stakeout anywhere around the property. The foursome parked a few blocks away, and then made their way back up the street in pairs, passing between the rectory and the church to reach the rear entrance. Olson pulled out his lockpicks and did his thing. It took him less than a minute to breach the structure, and they were inside with, they hoped, no one the wiser. From there, they quickly got to work.
It's gotta be here somewhere.
They'd been searching for 2 hours and still hadn't found anything remotely resembling the Red Templar cross that Kate had seen in his vision. They'd examined the pews, looking to see if the symbol had been carved into the surface. They'd searched each and every panel of the stained glass windows, wrongly assuming that something so bright would be hidden among things that were equally so. There, too, they'd come up empty, however. Riley had even used a set of binoculars to get a close look at the entire ceiling, and still they had nothing. Now they sat together at the edge of the altar platform, trying to decide on their next move. None of them doubted that there was something here to find. Kate's visions had never been wrong. But sometimes they had been more than a touch ambiguous, and this certainly seemed to qualify as one of those times. Each of the men were as frustrated as Kate was at this point.
Maybe it would be too literal.
What do you mean?
It's like this. Martin obviously knew someone was after him. Might have even known that they were aware of you and possibly the Order as well, right?
Right. Tell me something I don't know.
Well, then think about it. Now put yourself in Martin's shoes. If you knew someone was after you, knew that you had vital information that had to be passed on regardless of what happened to you personally, would you have left something in plain sight for anyone to find? Especially a symbol that the enemy might recognize?
Of course not.
But that's what we've been looking for. We're assuming that the cross you saw was something Martin was looking at in the final moments of his life. But what if that's not the case? What if he was simply focused on the Order itself? What if his hope for rescue simply translated into a mental image of the symbol of his rescuers?
Kate had to admit it was possible, but in this case, unlikely. He couldn't prove it, but he'd had the distinct sense that Martin had been trying to pass him a message, and whatever that message was, it was linked to a red cross. He glanced around the interior of the church, trying not to focus on anything in particular. Maybe Olson was right. Maybe they were being too literal. His gaze took in the rows of pews before him, and then moved on to the organ player's booth above them. He pivoted when he sat, turned his attention to the altar itself. He stared hard at the crucifix hanging on the wall behind it, let his gaze wander over the cloth-covered tabernacle in the rear corner, moved on to the lectern, then the plaque representing one of the stations of the cross on the wall nearby.
Wait.
He turned back. Something about the tabernacle. Then he had it. The tabernacle was a symbol of the Holy of Holies, the sacred chamber at the heart of King Solomon's temple. It was accessible only once a year, and then only by the high priest, for it was the place where God himself resided. Similarly, the Knights Templar hadn't always been known as such. Once, long ago, the order had been called another, more formal name, the Poor Knights of Christ of the Temple of Solomon. The temple, or the modern-day version, the tabernacle, was the place where the church and the order intersected. That had to be it. Kate jumped to his feet. He crossed the room and pulled back the cloth that covered the tabernacle. There, in the very center of the small gold door that allowed access to the storage space inside, was a keyhole outlined in red. A keyhole in the shape of a Templar cross.
Good for you, old man.
The small door to the tabernacle was locked, but that was only a minor deterrent to Cade. Now was not the time for niceties. He drew his combat knife from the sheath in his boot and was preparing to wedge the door open.
What are you gonna do with that?
What's it look like? I'm gonna open the door.
With that? Like hell you are.
Olsen pushed him out of the way, and Cade watched with not a little amusement as the other man bent over and examined the lock. Satisfied with whatever it was he saw, Olsen removed a small black leather case from a pocket of his fatigue pants and unzipped it, selecting two metal tools from inside it. He stuck the ends of both into the lock, fished around with them for a couple of seconds, and then removed them. Grinning, he stuck a finger in the keyhole and pulled. The door swung open on well-oiled hinges. Inside, they found the small gold container that was used to store the leftover host after Mass. Cade took it out and handed it to Olsen. He knew instinctively that what he was looking for wasn't inside it. Martin considered his priestly duties to be sacred, and he never would have compromised the Eucharist by storing anything in with the host. But the tabernacle itself was fair game. The interior of the small container was lined with black velvet, making it impossible to see anything in the dim light of the church. Cade ran his gloved hands against the velvet, looking for something stashed away inside the small space, and was only mildly surprised when his fingers encountered the hidden switch.
Heads up!
Glancing around, they all waited for something to happen. Nothing did. Cade frowned, pushed it again, and then did so a third time when everything still looked the same as it had before.
Think it's broken?
No, I just think we're not looking in the right spot. Spread out. It's here somewhere, I'm sure of it.
And it was. The switch activated a panel in the back of the wardrobe closet in the sacristy, revealing a staircase. Riley found it completely by chance. He was standing near the wardrobe when Cade flipped the switch for what must have been the 20th time, and heard the slight sound the panel made as it slid open. Cade had to give credit to whoever had built the place. It was a clever setup. Securing the controls inside the tabernacle ensured that no one was going to trip the mechanism by accident, and even if by some strange circumstance they did, nothing untoward would happen to give it away. There was a switch just inside the doorway that activated a set of bulbs strung along the ceiling, and by their light, Echo Team's command squad descended. At the base of the steps, they found a small chamber carved directly into the bedrock deep beneath the church. A single bare bulb hung from a makeshift socket in the ceiling. Its harsh light illuminated the small space, giving them a good look at the altar of native stone that stood in the center of the room. A small chest rested on the altar, flanked by two flat white church candles, the surface beneath them encrusted with the accumulation of years of melted wax. Next to one of the candles was a modern lighter. As they spread out through the room, the light sent their shadows dancing across the walls, and drew their attention to the mural painted on the one behind the altar. The mural stretched from floor to ceiling, covering a space about 10 feet square, and showed an image of a rock-strewn plain of gray that stretched out to a horizon where storm clouds gathered. It was a landscape without a focus, as if the artist had completed only the background and had yet to begin the subject of the painting itself. Cade knew better, however. He knew it was a finished image, knew that the artist had actually captured the bleak nature of the place quite well. He'd been there, had plenty of first-hand experience to make the necessary comparison. What he didn't know was what an image of the beyond was doing on the wall of a room hidden beneath the church.
Commander, I think you better have a look at this.
Kate turned to find that Olsen had opened the chest and was staring at its contents, a strange combination of amazement and disgust plain on his face. Kate stepped up beside him. Inside the chest, a mummified human hand rested on a bed of red silk. Kate reached inside and carefully drew it out of the box, wanting to get a better look. The hand had been severed about an inch below the wrist, providing a sort of handle with which to grasp it. A white, tallow-like substance coated the fingers, covering the blackened skin beneath, and gave off the thick scent of animal fat and candle wax. As the other men caught sight of the hand, they crossed themselves. Kay didn't blame them. The Hand of Glory was a potent piece of black magic, the kind of artifact that any self-respecting member of the church would avoid like the plague. Formed from the severed left hand of a murderer hung for his crime, the hand could be used for all manner of nefarious purposes. The Order actually had two in their possession. The first, taken from a warlock, who'd used it to put an entire complement of Templar soldiers to sleep when they'd stormed his stronghold. The other removed from the grave of a 16th century mystic that had been unearthed during routine street repair in the Whitechapel district of London 3 years before. Both of them were secured under heavy guard to keep them from falling into the wrong hands. Just what on earth had Father Martin been up to? Cade began mentally cataloging all of the uses of a Hand of Glory.
Putting your enemies to sleep, locating a missing person or object, forcing a confession from the servant of a witch, opening any lock or any door. Wait a minute.
Cade looked from the hand to the mural and back to the hand again, suspicions flaring. He grabbed the lighter from the altar top, clicked it on, and touched the flame to the tip of each finger, lighting each one like a candle. The stink of burning animal fat filled the room.
Wait a minute.
But Cade wasn't listening. He suspected he knew just what Father Martin was doing with the Hand of Glory, but the only way to be certain was to try it himself. Praying he was wrong, Cade turned and pointed the hand's burning fingers in the direction of the mural. Something passed between the hand and the wall, a force that was felt more than seen. The effects, however, became visible as the entire painting shimmered like a mirage seen under the desert sun, and then reformed once more, transforming the mural into a glistening web of arcane energy. It was a portal. And from the scene on the other side, it was clear just where that portal would take them, into the heart of the beyond. Cade stared at the portal with a mixture of amazement and disgust. Amazed that someone had apparently managed to create a permanent link to the beyond, when by its very nature, the beyond was always shifting and changing, never the same thing twice. And disgusted that they had bothered to do so at all. For try as he might, he couldn't think of a single worthwhile reason for doing so. It appeared he was going to have to reevaluate not only what he knew about the beyond, but about Father Martin as well. Leaving the portal open was an invitation for any manner of creatures to come crawling across the veil, so he waved the Hand of Glory at the wall a second time, and then snuffed out the flames burning in the fingertips. As the last one was extinguished, the wall shifted before their eyes once more, returning to its former solid state. It was looking more and more like they were going to have to chance making an incursion into the beyond to determine just what Father Martin had been using the connection for. There was also the chance that someone or something could open it from the other, which meant they were going to have to post a guard for the time being, until they could decide just what to do about it.
Just what did you get yourself into, old man?
Leaving Riley and Olsen to keep an eye on the gate, Kate climbed back up the stairs, pulling out his cell phone as he went. Back in the sanctuary, he began making a series of phone calls. His first one was to the duty officer at the Ravensgate Commandery, who he had transferred him to Echo's Barracks. There, he had someone track down Davis, First Squad's new leader. Cade had promoted him in the wake of Ortega's death inside the Eden Complex, and so far, Davis had been doing fairly well. Cade was confident that given a bit more time, he'd fit into the role as if he'd been born to it. Once Davis picked up the phone, Kate let him know that he was ordering first and second squads to grab their kits and meet him at his current location in Boston as soon as possible, knowing that Davis would relay the information to Wilson, second squad's leader. Regardless of what he found on the other side, Kate knew they were going to need backup to handle the task of guarding the portal. You couldn't mount a round-the-clock operation with just four men. By getting the ball rolling now, he was increasing his options for later, and Kate liked to be prepared wherever and whenever he could. It was one of the traits that had made him so successful as Echo's leader. That done, Kate hung up and took a moment to consider what he intended to say before dialing the Preceptor's direct line.
Preceptor's office, Nichols speaking.
Knight Commander Williams for Preceptor Johansson.
I'm sorry, Commander. The Preceptor is in a meeting at the moment and is currently unavailable.
Kate grinned, just as he'd hoped. Now, if the incompetent fool would only stay in meetings until this was over, things might actually go pretty smoothly.
That's fine. Please let him know I called and that he can call me back whenever he finds a free moment.
Very well, Knight Commander.
The aide's attitude was almost enough to match that of his boss, but Cade knew the message would be relayed almost verbatim, which was exactly what he wanted. The Preceptor didn't like him. That had been obvious from the start. He would consider any request from Cade that wasn't labeled as urgent to be of no consequence, and would ignore it out of sheer spite, which would leave Cade to do as he pleased, just as he'd hoped. Closing his flip phone, Cade turned away, intending to return to the crypt hidden below the church, but then stopped, took his phone back out, and dialed another number.
What?
Cade wasn't surprised by the greeting. It was how Clearwater always answered the phone.
It's me again.
Something happened? Did the wards collapse?
Oh no, nothing like that. I just need your services again.
You didn't dig another one up, did you?
God, no. I've been called away on urgent business and I can't make it back home for several days. I need someone to watch over her until I get back.
There was silence on the other end of the line.
I'll pay you double your normal rate just to sit there and keep an eye on her. I'll be back in a few days and that will be it. I won't drag you into this again.
Fine. A few days, no more.
She hung up without saying goodbye. Cade wasn't surprised. Clearwater might be the best hedge witch he knew, but she wasn't comfortable around people and her social skills were less than developed. No matter, she knew her job, and she would protect Gabrielle until he could get back there to do it himself. With that taken care of, he turned and made his way back down the stairs to the room below. It was time to begin preparations for a short trip through the portal into the beyond. They had to find out what Father Martin had been involved with, and passing through the portal was the quickest way to discover that information. Cade normally would have made the trip across the Vale on his own, but this time he wasn't comfortable with that idea. Just about anything at all could be waiting for them on the other side, and he wanted not only another set of eyes and ears to be certain he didn't miss anything, but also someone who could carry what they learned back to the Order should something happen to him. As executive officer, Riley had to stay behind and manage the unit while Cade was gone. Duncan had been across the Vale before, but finding the portal beneath a church clearly had him shaken up, and Cade didn't think dragging him through it was the best thing right now, which left Olson. With the decision made, Cade rejoined the others in the secret room below the church and filled them in on his intentions.
We need a better understanding of why this portal exists and what Father Martin used it for before we report the discovery to High Command. The only way to do that is to go through it and scout around a bit on the other side. Once we do, we'll have a better idea of how the Order needs to react. Olson, you're with me. Suit up, but leave your firearms behind. They don't work on the other side anyway.
As Olson headed up the stairs to retrieve their kit bags from where they'd left them in the church above, Kate turned to the other two.
You two are on guard duty. Give us a couple of hours. If we're not back by then, report in and let the Seneschal know about the portal.
With the orders given, there wasn't anything left to do but gear up and get things underway. Olson and Cade stood before the reactivated gate, with Riley and Duncan at their backs. Knight Commander turned to face his companion.
You'll feel some resistance as you pass through the gate, but just push through it and you'll be fine. I'll go first, and we'll be waiting for you on the other side.
Without waiting for an answer, Cade faced the gate, drew his sword, and took the last several steps needed to carry him into the shimmering portal. There was a moment of bitter cold and a sense of absolute abandonment so profound that if he hadn't been expecting it, Cade would have curled up in a corner and wept. He found himself standing inside the ruins of a small room. The hazy illumination that passed for sunlight was filtering in through a nearby doorway, giving Kay just enough light to see by. The ceiling above his head had partially collapsed, and if he hadn't come through the portal hunched over slightly, he probably would have smacked his head on it. He turned to face the portal, and through its shifting, shimmering surface, he could just make out the hazy forms of Olsen and Riley standing on the other side. Lifting a hand, he gave the signal, and then stepped away from the portal, making room for Olsen, who came through moments later. Olsen was shaking violently when he emerged, and Cade gave him a moment to gather his wits. The passage through the veil was never an easy one, and that space between worlds could feel like forever to the uninitiated. Cade had made the trip multiple times while searching for Gabrielle and had become hardened to the experience. But aside from their encounter with the Angel Barakel, who had thrown Echo's entire command unit violently across the gap, this was Olsen's only trip into the beyond, and Cade knew it would be disconcerting, to say the least.
You okay?
Ugh. That was a bit freakier than I expected, but I'll be okay in a minute.
Good. I'd hate to embarrass you in front of the other men by sending you back.
Fat chance of that.
Satisfied, Cade crossed the room to the doorway and looked out. Olsen joined him. The beyond was still very much a mystery to Cade, despite his many journeys there. As nearly as he could tell, it was a shadow realm that existed close to the real world in time and space, but forever separated by a wall of energy he had come to call the Veil. Like the mystical purgatory, it was inhabited by the shades of the dead, those that for one reason or another had not moved on to a more lasting rest. Other creatures inhabited the beyond as well, dark, twisted creatures of all shapes and sizes, and one had to be on their guard at all times while journeying there. To make matters worse, the landscape of the beyond was constantly shifting. Like a funhouse mirror, it had a tendency to make things appear either hauntingly familiar or intimately strange. This side of the veil could often seem to be a mirror image of the other, except here the passage of entropy marked everything with a patina of decay. Cade liked to think of it as a photograph and its negative image. Sometimes, though, the beyond was simply different, like now. In the real world, the church under which the portal was situated was in the midst of a suburban neighborhood, surrounded by other buildings, from two-family homes to the local grocery. But here, that wasn't the case. Before them stretched a sea of what could only be called vegetation, though it was unlike any vegetation any human had ever seen. Dark and twisted, it hung across everything in its path like a spider's web, seeming to squeeze everything in its iron grip. Looking behind them, they could see that the shell of the building from which they had emerged was covered with it. In fact, it was the growth that had caused the collapse of the structure, the heavy boughs forcing the roof partially down into the rest of the building. A path led down the small hill on which the church rested to what appeared to be a roadway, both of which had been carved from the center of the vegetation. Cade could see burn marks along the edge of the path, evidence that it had been cleared recently, and there were faint tracks in the dirt beneath their feet. With no other direction available to them, they set out along the path.
Hear that?
Yeah, it's just the wind.
The wind wasn't blowing. Cade turned in a slow circle, looking for movement, hoping to catch sight of something moving toward them through the vegetation.
Can you tell where it's coming from?
Olsen shook his head. He was glancing around as well, one hand on the hilt of his sword. Out of the corner of his eye, Cade saw motion, and he spun in that direction. He was just in time to see a lengthy piece of vine slide out across the path ahead of them. As if sensing his scrutiny, it suddenly went limp. If he hadn't been looking right at it, Cade would have convinced himself that it had only been a trick of the light. But he had been looking, and it hadn't been the light.
Cover me.
Olsen stepped closer, sword drawn, while Cade drew an emergency flare from the cargo pocket of his utilities and with a flick of one hand, activated it. From previous travels, Cade knew the flame would make him sick to his stomach if he stared at it too long, so he avoided looking at it, turning his attention instead to the vegetation lining the path. Once it was lit, he held the flare in one hand and drew his sword with the other. Striding forward, he thrust the flame at the vine that had flopped across their path. Faster than a striking snake, the vine whipped itself back into the dense foliage behind it. One minute it was there, the next it was not.
Are you freaking kidding me?
Afraid not. I'd say that's a pretty good indication we should stick to the path, wouldn't you?
Following his example, Olson lit a flare of his own, and the two of them continued on their journey, moving down the path. A little later, they reached the wider road. It ran perpendicular to their current direction, and from the tracks beneath their feet, it was clear that the traffic had been moving to the left only. They had come to find out who or what was using the portal, so Cade followed the tracks. Ruined buildings could now be seen beneath the vegetation on either side of the road, and putting two and two together, Cade understood just what had happened to the neighborhood around the church. This was a mirror image of the reality that existed on the other side of the veil, except in this case, the vegetation had grown abnormally large and had developed a sentience of its own. It had swallowed the town whole, smothering it beneath a sea of creeping vines. Everything but the road. Someone was keeping that open.
But for what?
Ahead of them rose a series of rugged hills covered with a dense growth of forest. The road continued up and over them, passing through the trees. Both men were leery about entering the woods, but they discovered that the trees were just ordinary. Whatever had animated the vegetation in the valley behind them had apparently been restricted to that area, much to their relief. As they climbed higher, they began to see the ruins of buildings here and there among the trees. Curiosity eventually got the better of them, and they began making occasional detours to check out particularly interesting locales. More often than not, there wasn't much left, just a series of walls open to the sky above, and the occasional piece of furniture that had survived the ravages of the elements, and whatever denizens of the beyond that made the forest their home. They left the ruins behind and climbed up the lee side of the ridge as quietly as possible. As they drew close to the rim, they got down on their bellies and crawled. At the top, they carefully peered over the edge. Below them, across the valley floor, was a large encampment spread out amongst more ruins like those they had just left behind. Cade counted 30 tents, each one with round sides and a sloping roof, similar to a Mongolian yurt. They appeared easy to set up and take down, and probably didn't require too much effort to transport. A large structure could also be seen in the center of the camp, consisting of several tents strung together, their rectangular styles in sharp contrast to the circular ones around them. Figures moved about the camp, but they were too far away to be seen clearly. But Olson was prepared. He pulled a pair of mini binoculars from the cargo pouch on his pants and took a long look through them. Without a word, he passed them to Cade. From the expression on Olson's face, Cade knew it couldn't be good. He took a look for himself. The camp was full of Changshi. They were making preparations for something. From the size and number of the boxes and crates that were being moved about the camp, it was clearly a major undertaking. Cade knew that the Changshi were typically solitary creatures, and it took either a strong militant commander or the promise of lush hunting grounds to bring even a handful of them together as a group. To assemble a force of this size, the prize must be particularly attractive, like the entire city of Boston.
There has to be 150, maybe 200 of them down there.
But Cade barely heard him. His attention had been caught by a familiar face, and he shifted position, doing what he could to keep the individual in sight while focusing the binoculars for a better look. Olson noticed Cade's change in intensity.
What is it?
Cade didn't answer, not yet, wanting to be sure before he said anything. But then he finally had the glasses focused the way he wanted, and there was no question about the individual's identity.
Bishop.
Cade handed the glasses back to his companion.
About 10 yards in front of that main structure and a couple of feet to the left.
Wow. I don't see... Son of a bitch, there he is.
Cade nodded. What he would have done for an operational sniper rifle at that point. He caught Olson's eye, and with a nod of his head, indicated that they should get going. Olson silently agreed, and the two men made their way back off the ridge and moved away from the Changshi encampment. When they were out of earshot, they spent a few minutes discussing the situation. It seemed obvious that the road continued around the ridge and passed through the center of the town that the Changshi had claimed as their own. If they used the ruins they just left behind as a staging area and had enough reinforcements, Cade's men might be able to get into position for a strike at the camp without being seen, though a lot would depend on good timing and a healthy dose of luck. Either way, it was clear that they had to get back to the other side of the veil and inform the order of what they had seen. The decision as to what to do about the Chengxi would be made by others higher in the Order's hierarchy, and for that both men were grateful, but they didn't fool themselves into thinking that they wouldn't be part of the solution. There was a fight coming, and Echo was bound to be at the vanguard of it. It was time to get back and warn the others of what they had seen. With a last glance toward the ridgeline and the threat that lay just beyond, Cade turned and headed back down through the woods toward the road, with Olsen at his heels.